Hello! Here it is, another episode from the Untold Civil War podcast. This time, I tried something a little bit different. Instead of focusing on just one topic, I've invited Matt Borders and Patrick McGuire from the History Things podcast to come on and share a few of our favorite Untold Civil War stories. These are some really great guys, and making the episode was a lot of fun. It is longer than my usual episodes, but the content is awesome. Now, before we get started, please go and follow Matt Borders and Patrick McGuire on social media and give their podcast a listen. Links will be in the show notes. I am a personal fan of their podcast. Finally, grab yourself a bottle of Red Eye and head down to Smoky Row, where the ladies of the night will share with you some untold Civil War. So today on the Untold Civil War podcast, I am sitting with two legends in the history podcasting community. I'm with Pat McGuire and Matt Borders. It's a real treat to have them on the podcast, and we'll be discussing not only how did they get involved in the world of history storytelling, but also sharing some of our favorite stories of Untold Civil War. Welcome to the podcast, guys. Thank you for coming.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Paul. Thank you.
So I think we can just kick this off real quick is just, how did you guys get involved in history storytelling and the Civil War?
Sure. I'll start with that. This is Matt, and I actually came at it from a rather traditional direction, if you will, the academic side of things. I have always had a passion for history. My folks took us on the classic throw everybody in the minivan and drive across the country summer vacations, and that's what really started my love for history, particularly when we went to Gettysburg. And I was fascinated by the Civil War, this concept of the country tearing itself apart, and then even, at least to some extent, knitting itself back together again. And so I wanted to find out more about that and how it was done. Began to devour everything I could on the war. Fortunately, one of my best friends back home in Michigan was also a burgeoning Civil War nut himself. And so we really sparked off of each other. We'd be comparing books and talking battles and gear and all that other good stuff, watching Gettysburg over and over. And when it came time for college, I pretty quickly gravitated towards a history degree, got a bachelor's in U.S. history from Michigan State. And during my summer months for 3 of my 4 years, I was either interning or seasonaling for the National Park Service. And that's when I decided that I wanted to do historic education, but not in the traditional classroom setting. I actually did teach for a little while, briefly, right after I got out of my master's degree. I taught a little bit of undergrad at a community college and also did K through 12 substituting for a brief period as well. But I pretty quickly realized that my passion and my real abilities laid in the Park Service and that teaching on the ground where the history happened. So I've been building and working through my career since then. I'm still with the Park Service. I'm actually at Monocacy National Battlefield, which is going to come up in one of our talks this evening. And I have since gotten involved with guiding for other battlefield sites, Antietam National Battlefield. And I last year became an author with my first book, Faces of Union Soldiers at Antietam, with a fellow guide, Joseph Stahl. And Pat was gracious enough to actually interview me for the first time on that book. So that's kind of one of our early works together. But Pat actually has a really interesting angle on how he came into history, because he didn't follow that kind of classic route. So
yeah, I'm still in the process of actually crashing into this industry like a wrecking ball, as I like to do kind of everywhere. I'm very much a bull in a china shop kind of person. So my entrance to this field would be out of character if it was anything other than that. So I kind of got here by accident. Professionally today, I'm a contractor. I work in construction, specifically like home remodeling. So doing like windows, roofing, and siding. But before that, in another life, I was a professional musician. And I used to play in a band that kind of gigged and had this short-lived flair. It was a lot of fun. And when that was kind of ending, there was a lot of other aspects or facets of my life that were changing, because as a young, very smart man, I put all my eggs in the I'm going to be a famous guitar player basket. And so obviously when that worked out, you know, end of story, I'm not even here today. It's like, I'm just kidding. No, when that didn't work out, as it does in most cases, with my eggs in one basket, I found myself in kind of a weird spot. So I went through a really dark and weird phase. You know, there was like a breakup with a girlfriend, and it was like a long-term thing. So it was like I got in this really weird and emotional place, and I kind of got brought out of it through a series of battlefield trips that just a buddy of mine, who was hanging out with me a lot to kind of like lift up my spirits, you know, he kept taking me to Gettysburg or Antietam, and he kept asking me questions. And I didn't realize that this little nerd that had been born when I was like 8 years old had stayed with me throughout these different aspects of my life. So when I was eight, I learned about John Brown. I was at Harper's Ferry with a U.S. history teacher from Winston Churchill High School in Montgomery County, Maryland. His name is Doug Krause. Thank you, Doug. You basically lit the fire that is everything I do now in the history world. He told the story, and we had just barely learned about the Civil War in school right before we let out for the summer. And so I kind of connected the dots. I was like fascinated. And obviously I grew up in the Ken Burns era. So like I was probably 4 or 5 when that came out. And I really remember watching it, not understanding it, but my dad watched it and he was into it. So I watched it and was into it, and it just stuck. And so when I start getting asked all these questions by my buddy, you know, when I'm in this, like, you know, I'm a burned out, washed up musician phase, I started having answers I didn't realize I had. Like, I can interpret things a little better than your average person, because like while I was still touring, I was reading and I was on an off day. I was going to visit a site and stuff like that. So it just kind of never went away. And so when I was at this crossroads moment of my life, I was in the middle of kind of layman's terms, barroom style, I guess you could say, explaining Dan Sickles' movements on July 2nd, 1863. We were standing on the boulders at Devil's Den, and I was telling my buddy, you know, about, you know, what Dan did, and I was using words like, you know, petulant. I was throwing my opinion around a lot. But I remember that there was a guy standing by listening very intently, and he was kind of cracking up, and he really enjoyed the storytelling, and he told me so after the fact. And I thought, you know, if I'm nothing else in life at this weird moment, I'm a really good storyteller. So I decided to start really, really learning these stories just so that I could tell them, because as Matt will tell you, the subject matter is very minutia heavy. It's very like small, minute detail heavy. And it's hard for anybody on an average or casual basis to kind of connect to this, which is why Gettysburg gets so much love, because it's such a big battle and it becomes like the Civil War Disneyland because the movie, and there's so much pop culture behind it that people are like, cool, I don't really need to ask questions. I know the name Chamberlain, and they can kind of connect to it. So my job, I felt, since I have, I don't like using the term like gift, but like I feel like I'm pretty good at telling a barroom version of a story, was like, maybe I'll up the game a little bit and tell a slightly better, slightly deeper than normal barroom version of the story, but still kind of come at it with like that attitude. And so I created my Facebook page. A few people started following me. It took some time. I found my voice. And when I had grown into this place, I realized this brand I had created, which is called History Things with Pat. You can follow it on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. When I realized that this brand I had created had, you know, established itself in the like writing traditional narratives for like on this day in history, like, you know, walking you through the event of the day or composing like, you know, small videos, or, you know, I have a job, like I say, in construction that puts me in a lot of places on any given day. So I can kind of broadcast to like, hey, like, check it out. I'm at, you know, such and such place and bring you a lot of content. I decided, like, you know, once all these things were kind of established about me, it was like really time to do something that got truly back to the art of storytelling, because that's the thing that this is all founded on, and that's what I'm good at. And over the years, I you know, made a friendship with Matt because of, you know, Matt being a ranger at the battlefield in the town I live in. So like Matt and I are both local. We live about 5 minutes apart from each other. So as you know, I got to know Matt on a professional basis because I do living history and we used to frequent that park that he was at. So Matt used to have to check in my rifles and do all that stuff. So before we were even friends, he was, you know, sort of this like living history volunteer boss. And he was a real cool guy. And I really started to like the way he told stories on the battlefield relating to Monocacy. He had a very, I don't know, it was just approachable the way that he told a story. Like, it was complicated material and he was just delivering it in a way that it was like easy to listen to for me, which is hard. Unless I'm really looking at it, just hearing something is hard to digest. And Matt just naturally it vibed with me. So I was like, cool. So, you know, as we became friends, I've always kicked around this idea of doing a podcast. And I always knew that I never wanted to do it just as a solo podcast, because as much as I love like Dan Carlin's podcast, and he's like a huge inspiration for like almost everybody in the history podcasting world, one of the things that I wish Dan did more of was kind of discuss the material he was delivering. I wish he had like a sidekick to kind of banter for a minute, because he does say some things that provoke questions. And I also like, I'm a big sports fan. Like I love sports. It's like, you know, things that are important in your life, like family, like history, like sports are like right there for me, right under all that stuff. So I grew up listening to sports talk radio, and it's just undeniable, the formula of people kind of talking to each other. It feels good. People like it. So I always knew that if I was going to do it, I needed a co-host. And if I was going to have a co-host, I needed someone that was A, able to handle my personality, because I'm a bit of a type A. And as Matt can tell you, like, I never stop. Like, I'm like 100 miles an hour creative at all times. And like, I need somebody to kind of be the valve that checks everything. And I also needed a co-host that was going to provide a depth that I couldn't. And Matt was absolutely the first person and kind of the only person I actually wanted to do this with when I decided to do it, because I think that you need to have some similarities and some differences in storytellings. And I think Matt and mine's ebb and flow really worked. And so, you know, we started the History Things podcast. And as we developed it, we started to hang out a lot, and not just, you know, front of the show, but like getting drinks on a regular basis and just telling each other stories. And it was like, dude, we're really good at this. So that's kind of how we ended up here, was that, you know, the History Things podcast just kind of grew out of a need that both of us have just to teach and connect and to make sure that you're understanding the material being presented to you. Because it's not everybody learns the textbook way, and not everybody learns the lecture way, or the watch this video or read this Facebook post. Some people, you know, don't have the time for that. They got hours of commuting, and, you know, a good way to reach them is this. So the History of Things podcast was born, and in the time that we've been on the air, it's been amazing. I guess is the word, Matt. Like, it's been amazing, and I couldn't be happier. And so that's our story. That's how, you know, Matt came in and I came in, and like wrecking balls, here we are, the History of Things podcast.
That's fantastic. I mean, I love the story, and it's so true. I love the podcast as well. It makes my commute to work a heck of a lot easier, as much as I hate driving over there, you know.
We're glad to hear that part.
But again, the reason I asked that question is I've received a lot of questions on my Instagram about how can we get involved in studying history. Well, you know, to my listeners, here you go. Here are two examples of very different ways that people have found their path in the history field. Right. So I'm glad you guys were able to share that for my listeners. Another thing, maybe this could be a message to museums or historical sites, but with all of the COVID happening now, what do you think about this outlet of podcasting, of, you know, using social media to tell the story of history? With COVID, I know it's a horrible thing, but has it not opened up other ways, other creative ways to tell the story? What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's interesting that you asked that, Paul, because I know Pat's going to have a pretty good rabbit hole to go down with this one, because he's actually discussed this very topic with some other colleagues of ours. But I very much agree with the idea that this is forcing many of my colleagues and cohorts in the museum industry, in the National Park Service, in the history field in general, to really look outside the box. Until Pat approached me with this idea of doing a podcast together, it was not honestly on my radar. I was familiar with podcasts to a point. I mean, I'd listened to Carlin, Dan Carlin, quite a bit, a big fan of his work, but it wasn't something that I saw myself doing. So I was very flattered to be invited to do this first off, but because of everything that has happened with COVID and the lockdowns and everything else, I'm also very, very thankful that I've gotten involved with it, and I've begun to learn the process. Now, Pat's the backbone of the technical side of things for certain. I do not have his background in editing and software and the like that he got through his career in music, but it's learning about how to use these programs, how to interact with folks online, how to use the social media in general, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Zoom for that matter. It's been a very interesting experience and something that I know that I'm utilizing in my career with Park Service and outside of it.
I think that this has been an amazing awakening in a time of calamity, for lack of a better, lack of a better word. But, you know, for a long time, the established sort of museums and other establishments, I guess, not to double up on established there, but people just sort of accepted that there's kind of like one way to do this. I hate the expression, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat, but there's kind of like that philosophy has not truly always been accepted in the history community. So like, Matt's right. Like I have deep dived on this a lot, and I've actually, for everybody's sake, I've gotten really good at shortening this down. So one thing I wanted to say, I wanted to actually backtrack because I did want to make a point to like answering, you know, a simple way about connecting to this and getting started. Like people that just, if you want to do it, you just got to go and do it. Like start reading. It can start with a simple Google search. If you like something, deep dive it. Find out why you like it. If a story happened a certain way, find out why it happened that way. You know, like I try to start at the end and work my way backwards. It helps me understand things. And so like there's a reason that Nike's slogan is that successful. Just do it. It's very simple. It makes a lot of sense. And it kind of is just all about self-responsibility. So if studying anything, history, music, sports, whatever, art, if it's something you want to do, just do it. And that's my only suggestion. So, but with the deep dive answer, just to shorten it down, is it basically, I think that the use of Zoom and things has kind of just ushered in this acceptance of the way things are, whether like the people that are in places to influence the community or not wanted to. So like social media, for instance, has been around for, you know, a good long time, but only recently are you starting to see things like national parks and state parks and museums and historical trusts and stuff use these Facebook lives, Zoom calls, broadcast live from a battlefield, things like that, virtual tours. You're only starting to see it now. And there's a part of me that views that as kind of silly because this stuff has been around. So I think this has been a great awakening. Pardon me. Been hanging out down here at the beach. I'm down here recording this live in Nagasaki, North Carolina. So I've been out hanging out with the fam and doing a lot of stuff. So I guess I'm losing my voice. So I apologize. Which will make the third time now throughout the course of my podcasting career that I've lost my voice. So this is a really awesome, really awesome reoccurring thing. But the community is starting to really accept it, and it's starting to flourish, and it's starting to connect people. And I think that that's brilliant because that's ultimately what this is all about. Because it just simply boils down to a matter of philosophy, and whether people realize it or not, teaching is sales. In a sense. And right now with the way that the generation is turning over and turned over again, and the way that we have sort of changed the way that we teach the American Civil War, like we're losing the sales battle. That's why there's that argument made that history is boring and people aren't interested. Well, the only people that say that are the people that didn't do a great job teaching it and making sure people stayed interested and engaged. So now that there's these vessels to engage with, kind of everywhere, and they're super accessible, it's really helped the community to kind of grow. And you've seen, like, our podcast works a lot with Addressing Gettysburg, Matt Callery up there in Gettysburg. We host a trivia night every other Wednesday on Google Meet, and we do a Sunday and Wednesday chat, which was born because of the COVID. We couldn't get together and hang out, so we started to get together and have just kind of historical chats. So I think it's just helped the community flourish.
And just that plug there for Addressing Gettysburg, I got to say, what a great podcast. What a great guy. He's always out there helping out everyone else doing other podcasts. When I started this thing, he was one of the first people to reach out to me and to help me out. So just a plug for him, just to say, you know, great guy, Matt Callery, please. Yeah.
That's good.
Give him a listen if you haven't listened to him already. Just to piggyback off that, I think that's so true about before this happened, without Zoom, without Facebook live tours, right, of battlefields, a lot of this stuff was inaccessible to a lot of people simply because they couldn't travel there. I'm not saying don't go to the battlefields now. Please go to the actual battlefields. You'll learn so much more if you're actually there. But I think this does give them an opportunity for people who don't have that ability to still get access to great material. So this is great stuff. But to go from there, I realized when I reached out to you guys, I sort of painted myself in a little bit of a corner. I advertised myself as the Untold Civil War Podcast. And when I invited you guys onto the podcast, I thought, holy smokes, did I just challenge Matt Borders and Pat McGuire to tell untold Civil War stories? I said, oh my God, what have I done? Because I knew you guys were going to bring your A game. So I am excited. I am excited to hear your stories. And I'd love to get into that. So whoever would love to start, I think I've got some great stories. I know you guys got some great stories. So I think Pat's going to lead the way, right?
Yeah, I'll kick us off here. So I appreciate it again. Thank you so much for having us on. I'll actually be real honest. The stories that I brought today are stories that I have actually told publicly before. But they still, as cool as they are, and as this sort of once a year basis that I'm telling them publicly that a schedule that I'm on, they still kind of remain untold, because as we were discussing pre-show, there's a ton of details of this war. So, you know, we kind of get lost the further down into the individual level we go. So the average observer, the average studier stays up, brigade, division, corps, army, et cetera. And if we're talking about individual people, we're usually talking about people wearing a lot of brass. So my stories are not really so much about the people wearing brass or any of that stuff. And they're not even really necessarily about any battles or things like that. They're sort of more human interest stories, I guess you could say. And the first story I'll tell you about is a bit of an interesting story, not just in the subject matter of the story, but the story, like the composition of the story itself, because there is a ton of this story that is kind of rooted in folklore. And the problem with it is there's a little bit of fact to back it up. So there's this weird like area where you kind of got to dance between what is the legend and what is the story, like the actual historical record story. So the reason I present it as a sort of historical offering is it's a story. I'm not presenting this as this is a factual lesson. I will make note of some of the things that are fact. And the rest of this, like I very much encourage you to study this when I'm done, because it's one of these stories where, like, if depending on who you ask, there's a different sort of genesis for it, or I guess course to how it happens. So my story comes from the West, out in the borderlands between Tennessee and Kentucky. My story is the tale of a renegade sniper, perhaps the inspiration for Mel Gibson's Benjamin Martin character, at least for a moment in the movie The Patriot, even though the timelines don't work, but like when you get into what we're talking about, you'll see. My story is the story of Jack Hinson, better known as Old Jack. So Jack Hinson, better known as Old Jack Hinson, was a farmer and slave owner in Stewart County, Tennessee. During the American Civil War, Hinson would lead a small group of Confederate partisan scouts that operated in the area between the Tennessee and the Cumberland Rivers. Though he was active as a scout between 62 and 65, Old Jack is perhaps best known for a bit of like legend or urban legend. There is a lot of mystery surrounding the real life of Jack. And what we know of him comes mostly from a piece of historical fiction, like a single book. So that's where a lot of this, you know, story comes from, weirdly, is like this modern contemporary piece of historical fiction. So take everything we say with, you know, this Jack Hinson guy with a grain of salt and do your own research. So here we go. So what is known, though, about Jack is that he did own and operate a plantation. It was called Bubbling Springs, and he had a very large family. And we're talking about like 10 kids, guys. This guy had 10 kids. I have a 1.5-year-old. I only have one. She is amazing. She is a handful. So I don't know how this dude handled 10 kids. As just parent to parent, good on you. But he was a slave owner, so F that guy. So we know that despite the notion that Hinson was a apolitical, because that's sort of the way that Jack Hinson is often presented, is that he's this apolitical guy. Despite this notion, the reality is during the time of the 1860 and 61 secession crisis, Hinson is very pro, you know, Southern independence, and he's going to vote for it twice. In 1861, Tennessee is going to hold elections in February and in June, I believe, and he's going to vote, according to the Dover County records, yay in both of those elections. So for a guy who's apolitical, he's certainly got, you know, a political stance. So you can see where this already is kind of like, you know, pulling you in two different directions. So we also know that in addition to Hinson's partisan service during the war, at least two of his sons are going to take up arms against the Union as well. Now, before we get real into this story, some of the things about Old Jack that are definitely true. Firstly, when the war broke out, at least militarily in 1861, Jack does try to stay out of the war. While being pro-Confederate in terms of belief, he's not really into the actual fighting, and he does want to sort of stay out of that. So he's kind of like operating like a lot of people in the border regions of Tennessee and Kentucky, you know, whereas Kentucky as a whole is kind of just trying to stay out of it. He's just kind of like, stay over there, but go south. And so when the war breaks out, you know, he tries to stay out of it. And the other thing is, you know, while his two sons are enlisting, you got to remember that Jack is an older guy. You know, he's got 10 kids. Jack's in his mid-50s. So he's not going to be running off and enlisting anyway. So his staying out of the war isn't also this weird, like, altruistic, I'm above this kind of thing. Like, he's an old guy. Like, he would have fought in Mexico kind of thing. Like, that would have been his war if he was going to be a guy on the ground. So, and war, as it often is kind of a younger man's game. And he's just simply not a younger. So secondly, we know that in 1862, as General Grant is putting some of the first significant W's of the war in the win column for the Union, Grant appears at the home of Bubbling Springs. Now, his presence is a bit of a matter of debate. We don't know if he's hosted willingly by the Hinsons or if he just sort of requisitions the place for his headquarters. But what is a matter of record is that Grant does, for at least a few days, operate or maintain a headquarters at the Bubbling Springs plantation in Stewart County, Tennessee. Now, the fall of both Forts Henry and Donelson is also going to mean that this vital gateway into the Confederacy is going to bring sort of a permanent fixture of Union troops to the Tennessee and Kentucky border region. And so with Grant's army moving through and all these, you know, not just Grant's army, but a lot of Union troops are now moving through this area with the gateway open. But with this influx of Union soldiers in this pro-Confederate region, it's going to cause some of these these sympathetic non-combatants to take up arms to defend their homesteads from these perceived invaders. So using these guerrilla tactics and things, it's also known as Indian fighting at the time, these bushwhackers, they're going to use the woods or other concealments, and they're suddenly going to start jumping out and attacking Union soldiers, and they're going to just start disappearing. And if the bushwhackers weren't annoying enough for these bandits, along come sort of these predecessors to the cowboy gangs of the Old West. You start to see a lot of these roving bandits that sort of are preying on these towns that are like, sort of trying to keep the Union out, and they're also running low on resources and things. Try to think about the movie Cold Mountain and try to think about the Home Guard unit at the beginning of that movie. Now, these Home Guard units, like I was saying, like it's shiesty, right? They're going to use, and I say Home Guard loosely because they're more like bandits, and they're using the guise of Home Guard units, and they're going to be attacking these towns, and they're murdering, they're robbing and raping, and the Union is just like, they've had enough. They can't separate who's these legitimate Confederate partisans from these just like evil, murderous bandits. And they decide to sort of adopt this new policy. So just so we're very clear, the Union Army is just going to sort of institute this like policy of apprehension and execution without trial. There is no habeas corpus. It's just kind of like if the Union Army catches you and suspects you of being a bushwhacker in this border region where the army is moving through and these people who had tried to stay out are now kind of galvanized and taking pot shots at guys. Now, if we catch you and we think you're bushwhacking, they're just going to tie you up and shoot you. There is no court for you. There is no jury. It's just over. Welcome to the war. Obviously, that's not a very popular policy in place, but that is the policy that is put in place. And this is the stage for the story of old Jack Hinson. So in the fall of 1862, while out on a hunting trip, just about a mile from his house, two of his sons, not the two that are enlisted in Confederate service, he's got 10 kids, so he's got a bunch of other kids. Two of Jack's sons were arrested by a patrol from Colonel William W. Lowe's cavalry. The boys, they're armed at the time because it's a hunting trip, right? And they're of age. I think one is 22 and one is 17. So, you know, when sort of caught red-handed out hunting, it, you know, it just looks bad, right? There's these two boys of fighting age. They're both armed, and they're in an area where Union soldiers have had shots taken at them, and so it just doesn't look good. So they're going to be tied to a tree and shot. This policy is swift. There is no conversation about it. It doesn't matter who your parents are kind of thing. And so these two boys are arrested and they're shot. And at this point in the story, we shift into some sort of crazy Hollywood movie that has elements of like medieval lore and some like strange revenge plot. So the story, as it's often told, can be found in the work of historical fiction, is that the boys, after they're shot, they're then dragged by horses back into town. We're talking like the Dover courthouse area. Their bodies then paraded around the courthouse square. I'm guessing this is some sort of like weird flex to show the Union Army's like seriousness in terms of like, screw you, guerrilla fighters, we're not playing around. And then inexplicably, we're going back to the time of King Henry here. The remains are decapitated and the heads are brought back to the Hinston estate. And so now we've just gone 0 to 100 real fast. And from this point, allegedly the whole family watches as some nameless lieutenant mounts the heads onto the gatepost. And before I continue, let's be clear about a few things here, guys. there is no corroboration or real evidence to suggest that the Union Army did time travel back and become King Henry VIII. After the execution of the two boys, or that manifested such incredible savagery, this would have been crossing some major lines. Despite the melees and the devastations of wars, just killing two boys and after the fact mutilating their remains like that in the parade, like that's that dog and pony show, that's just wrong. Like even in war, that's wrong. And because there's no corroboration kind of thing. So in an area that is as pro-Confederate as the Dover area, an act of gruesome violence such as that, you would think would likely galvanize those who hadn't been galvanized by just the presence of the Union Army, or at least people who were otherwise less invested. You'd think they would say something. There'd be more records of this. So the lack of any of this stuff leads me to believe that barbaric act didn't happen. But the story is that the boys are shot, dragged around, put on a show, heads cut off and mounted to the post in front of their family. And so now that I've done all this time kind of building this up, you know, I haven't even really started telling the story yet. It's all just kind of in stage setting. We're at the top of the hill. This is kind of like a roller coaster, you know? So I was just like, we're going up that ratchety part right there. So now we're at the top. So here we go, right? So Jack's reaction to this is as you would expect it to be a father's, you know, whether the barbarism is real or he's just hearing news that his sons were killed at the hands of this policy kind of thing. You know, he's distraught. And as a few times, I guess I should rather say, like, he just kind of snaps, right? I don't know how else to describe it. Like, Jack finds out two of his sons are dead, and he just sort of blows his load. And so the following story, this is really where it dances between the folklore and the history. So Jack snaps. He goes, like, full Benjamin Martin on these guys. He's going to have a custom 50 caliber rifle based on the Whitworth rifle. He's going to have it made for him, and he's going to go out on, like, a one-man revenge mission. So this is a guy who is presented often as, like, I want to stay out of the war, and I don't really want anything to do about it. And now you've forced my hand, and now I'm going to kill a bunch of these Yankees because you killed my sons. Sounds like Benjamin Martin, right? In reality, this is a guy who has been pro the war, or not pro the war, but he's been pro the Southern independence, at least pro the cause. And when the war finally came to his doorstep, he picked the side because he had already sort of drawn a line in the sand philosophically at the onset of this thing. And now the Union Army, unfortunately, I guess, gave him blood reasons to pick this side and get super involved. So setting up a base of operations in a cave above the Tennessee River, Jack begins targeting pretty much any Union soldier he comes across or that he could draw within his sight. So the story goes that the first soldier to be killed by Hinson is this nameless lieutenant, the guy that physically orders the death of his sons, the executions of his sons. And from there, Hinson has like this insatiable bloodlust, and he begins dropping Union soldiers on columns of march, patrols, you know, scouting the area left and right. And then even boats in the Tennessee and Cumberland rivers aren't safe. Basically, like I said, when he could draw you in his sights, he could shoot at you. So if he could get you off the coast, he could get you off the coast. And that's actually one of the more notable stories that comes out of Jack's sharpshooter career, is that when Jack is out on one of these renegade sniper hunting missions that he's on, you know, he's not out there just willy-nilly doing this. You know, he'll spend some time out in a position looking for targets, taking them out, moving to a new position, then retreating back to his safe spots and stuff like that. So when he's out on one of these excursions, I guess you could say, he's able to successfully force an entire Union riverboat to surrender due to the casualties that they were sustaining from the shots that Hinson was laying down on. You know, they're real precarious. They're out in the middle of the water there. So in this instance, so many men had killed that the captain of the riverboat beached the boat in an attempt to just sort of like do something. And he's going to raise a white tablecloth to, you know, signal the surrender. And they're just going to kind of hang around and wait to be captured. Now, Hinson is said to have been extremely humored by this, but, you know, obviously he's not a complete idiot, I guess, and knows that he's one guy hidden in the woods and things like that. So he's not about to go make himself known down on the riverbank to these, you know, Union troops who definitely outnumber him, because when he shows up and is like, I got you, there will be easily, you know, a turning of the tables, you could say. So as it goes down, as Hinson kind of sits there and he observes the scene, and these Union troops are all just kind of waiting around with their hands up, and Hinson kind of chuckles and then gets on out of there. After some time, the federal forces, they're really becoming aware of this renegade sharpshooter due to the higher than normal, or like the unique amount of deaths or casualties that are happening or befalling their troops in this region. And once they've sort of connected the dots to send a message to the elusive old man from Bubbling Springs, the estate itself, belonging to the Hinson family, is going to be burned to the ground. Now, quick note before John Hinson goes all Civil War Rambo. Hinson sent his family that was remaining at Bubbling Springs out west before he went and disappeared into the woods and became this vigilante sniper. So it's not like the Union Army was just out there killing people's sons and displacing families just for the hell of it. Their family was nowhere near it. The home was abandoned at the time. So they just kind of didn't leave anything for the family to come back to as the message. Now, as Jack Hinson's Hollywood movie revenge murder plot is playing out, some of the things that are actually known about Jack Hinson are happening. Jack has organized a small group of men to serve with him as scouts for the Confederate forces in the area. You got to remember, he's intimately familiar with every little road and path, nook and cranny of the coaling grounds that are between these two rivers. And Hinson provided valuable directions and intelligence to several notable Confederate commanders. In this capacity, he is perhaps best known for guiding Nathan Bedford Forrest during the latter's raid on the Union Supply Center at Johnsonville. Now, as his legitimate Confederate endeavors are taking place, and when I say that, I mean like there's an actual paper trail to sort of take you through historical record. It's not just like old grandpa told me this about old Jack. So as his legitimate Confederate record is taking place, Hinson continues his one-man war of retribution against the federal soldiers. And eventually, a pretty lofty reward is offered for his arrest or proof of his death. They didn't really care dead or alive. They just kind of wanted their guys to stop having this super exceptional bushwhacker. They didn't want him out there anymore. So, you know, they've got this warrant out for him, and Jack's going to be able to evade capture for the duration of war and even after, because the warrants remain active all the way up until when Hinson dies in 1874. All told, guys, Jack is credited by the Union Army records as having killed more than 130 men, which includes 36 officers. And the rifle that he is said to have done all this with, the famous, you know, custom Kentucky Whitworth style rifle, which is rumored to have weighed like 17 pounds, which is like seven more pounds, I believe, than your standard Springfield or Enfield long rifle at the time. The rifle is said to have been in the possession of the family of Major Charles W. Anderson, who is Nathan Bedford Forrest's aide-de-camp. And I guess the rifle was presented to him at the end of the war. And it is rumored to have 36 notches cut into the stock. I guess one for every officer killed, allegedly. I've never seen this rifle, and I don't really know if it's modern day existence, if the family still has it. So the war ends, and Jack, with the help of the locals, like I had said, he constantly stays on the move, and he's continuously able to evade capture. And despite the massive manhunt, he's successful all the way up until when he ultimately dies on April 28th, 1874. But Jack didn't just, like, you know, sort of get away with it, I guess you could say. It's a really maybe poor way to describe it because, you know, remember the genesis of this whole thing is that Jack lost two of his children to being suspected bushwhackers. So I don't really consider that a win, but Jack is able to evade capture. But the war is further costly to the Hinson family. So while he's successfully free until his death, the two sons that do engage in the Confederate army activity, just to be clear, one of them is in the actual Confederate army. The other one is in a more official home guard unit, not like Cold Mountain bushwhacker style. They're in like something like the Logan Wildcats, like the Hatfield and McCoys are a part of, on the West Virginia, Kentucky area. So there's some formality to them, but both of those boys are going to die, in service during the war. And two of his other children are going to die of disease. So all told, the Hinson family will lose six of their 10 children during the course of the 4 years of the American Civil War. So Hinson's an interesting story. I like to tell it because it's got some elements of an action movie that'll just kind of make you get pumped the way we do. Like when Mel Gibson goes chasing after that Brit, that troop or that small column, I guess, of British soldiers that are taking Heath Ledger away, and he catches up to him and takes them all out by himself and absolutely tomahawks the crap out of that guy. So, you know, it's action-packed of a story in that sense. But, you know, as historians, you know, you want to get
as close to the fact and as close to the truth as you can. And that's something that's really hard to do with Jack Henson, because the waters are murky. You know, there's a bunch of historical fact that contradicts the very famous folklore legend that exists about him. And some people like to stay in the folklore because it's convenient and fun. And other people like to just kind of abandon that and go down the factual path, which kind of strips the story away of any coolness. So I just present that as sort of a historical story, not so much as a historical lesson, just merely because there's so much that's still up in the air. And I always encourage you to do your own research and take a look at it yourself and come to your own conclusion about old Jack and you know, what he was about.
That's awesome. That's a crazy story, and definitely untold. I don't think that's found in most books covering the Civil War. So,
well, I'm actually going to stay in the Western theater for my story. This is a element of the Western War that I don't think gets talked about very much. One of my sub interests in the American Civil War is the Navy, the Civil War Navy. And I particularly had an interest or have an interest in the Brown Water Navy, those vessels that are on the riverways out west, the Ohio, the Cumberland, of course, the mighty Mississippi herself. And it would be through that research and interest that I ran across the Elliott Rams, ram ships on the rivers in the war. Now, as you guys know, the concept of ramming in naval warfare is ancient and can be traced back to at least the of the ancient Greeks in the 400s BCE. This style of warfare is going to fall out of favor, though, as better and better projectiles are invented and the move from road to sail-powered vessels and warships occurs. However, with the development of steam engines and iron-hulled ships, the concept of rams is going to find favor in some circles again in the mid-19th century. One of its early advocates was the brilliant engineer Charles Ellet Jr. Now, Ellet was a self-taught engineer and is best remembered for his work on suspension bridges and for flood control construction projects. However, in the 1850s, he began to petition the Navy Department, the United States Navy Department, about a steam-powered ram. He came to this idea through one of the tragedies of the day, the 1854 sinking of the SS Arctic. Now, Pat's got a real big interest in shipwreck history, so I wanted to mention this. The Arctic was accidentally rammed in a fog bank off Newfoundland by the French ship, the SS Vesta. Initially, it was believed that the iron-hulled 250-ton Vesta was in danger of sinking as the Arctic, a wooden sidewheel steamer weighing in at 2,794 pounds, or excuse me, tons, so 11 times larger than the Vesta, and they thought this little ship was one that was in trouble. It was soon discovered that the Arctic had been badly pierced below the waterline by the iron-hulled Vesta, and she is going to try to make a dash for shore. Unfortunately, she will sink well before reaching safety, and sadly, of the 400 people aboard, 85 survive, none of which are women and children. A good chunk of the crew and a number of the male guests or passengers get off, but none of the women and children survive, tragically. Now, this tragedy will actually inspire Ellet, but his ideas are going to be ignored initially by the War Department in the 1850s. He is then going to try to sell this idea of an iron-hulled ram to the Russians during the Crimean War, which also went nowhere. It was not until the outbreak of the American Civil War that the idea once again was brought up and began to gain traction. And that's going to happen primarily after February of 1862. In February of 1862, Ellet is going to write a pamphlet detailing his concerns of a powerful fleet of rams being built throughout the Confederacy, and that nothing was being done to counter the threat. Now, Paul, Pat, you and I both know that, of course, the Monitor is being built by this time. The Eads City-class ironclads on the Western waters are beginning to come online as well. These powerful vessels, ironclad vessels, that could potentially deal with these rams. But Ellet believes the best response to this Confederate threat are his rams. He wants to build his own. Now, these fears that he has and are put out there in his pamphlet only seem to be confirmed a month later when the CSS Virginia, of course, the, also known as the Merrimack, played havoc with the Union naval vessels in Hampton Roads, Virginia, prior to the arrival of the Monitor. Now, the Virginia had actually rammed the Cumberland, or the USS Cumberland, and sank her with a iron ram that darn near pulled the Virginia underwater too. Though driven away the next day by, or after I should say, the next day after her duel with the Monitor, the CSS Virginia had scared the War Department into action. Now, notice what I said there, the War Department, not the Navy Department. The Navy's got its own plan. It's got Monitor, and it's going to be experimenting with this design and some other ironclad designs. The War Department, though, is very, very concerned about what these Confederate rams could do to their transports and could do to their ability to progress the war along the waterways. And so it will actually be the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who is going to send for Ellet and would give him leave to purchase and outfit a number of rams for action on the Western River waters. 9 civilian vessels are going to be purchased, both sidewheel steamers and sternwheel steamers. These vessels had their prows reinforced, their machinery protected, but no guns added. They were to be rams through and through. Ellet was given the rank of colonel and was allowed to fill his vessels with any men he recruited, and he's going to recruit heavily, not only in the West and along the waterways, but also from his own family. This is a big kith and kin operation for the Ellets. At least 13 family members will serve on these vessels. Brothers, cousins, and other relatives are going to serve in this strange command, with Charles Ellet Jr. being the initial commander of it. Come to find out, this threat is not entirely overblown. Rams would attack Federal vessels. At Plum Point in May of 1862, the Confederate rams under Commodore James Montgomery's River Defense Fleet are going to engage and heavily damage 2 ironclads, 2 Union ironclads at Plum Point. And when this attack is heard about, Ellet and his small fleet of rams are going to be ordered south. Here is where we're going to run into an issue, because what did I say was, or I should say, who did I say that the rams were under? Not the Navy, the Army.
War Department.
War Department, exactly. Now, the Ellet rams being under the Army, being under the War Department, this is going to be an issue because they are to work in cooperation with the Union Navy, specifically Flag Officer Charles H. Davis's ironclad gunboats and support vessels. Ellet is not actually under Davis's command. They are working in conjunction. When Confederate forces pull back from the defenses of Memphis on June 4th, 1862, it's going to open up part of the river, part of the Mississippi. And this combined Navy-Army operation is going to advance down the Mississippi to what is known as Island Number 45. It's very close to a natural landmark at that time known as Patty's Hen and Chicks. I don't exactly know why it's called that, but I believe they are river obstructions. Now, Island Number 45.
Chickens? Like there's chickens in the river?
I don't think there are actual chickens in the river, but yes, that's the name of it, is Patty's Hen and Chicks. Island Number 45 is just north of Memphis, and as dawn breaks on June 6th, between 4:30 and 5 a.m., Confederate ships are seen chugging up the Mississippi River towards the anchored fleet. By 5:20, Flag Officer Davis's ironclads are beginning to pump shells towards those Confederate ships. But these are the big ironclads, and they take a while to get up steam, to get moving. It is because of these big, slow brawlers that Ellet sees a chance to show what his rams can do. On board his flagship, the Queen of the West, Ellet is going to wave his hat at his brother, who is commanding the Monarch, to get his attention, to get up steam, and to go. Now, the Queen of the West and the Monarch were much faster vessels than the big ironclads and quickly are going to slip between the lines of ships and begin to move directly towards the Confederate rams and vessels coming up the river. The Queen of the West is going to choose the CSS Colonel Lovell as her target, while Alfred Ellet later wrote that had the two vessels on, it likely would have destroyed both ships. However, the Lovell is going to fall prey to chicken first. It's like a game of chicken happening here, and the Lovell blinks first. It begins to turn away, and the Queen of the West is going to catch her amidships and almost cut that friggin' ship in half. When this occurs, the monarch is going to actually be struck, or excuse me, it will strike the CSS General Price and force it aground, and it's going to be run aground to prevent it from sinking, so it's also out of action. As this was happening, the Queen of the West is going to be hit herself by two of these Confederate rams. She's going to be hit in both sides by the CSS Beauregard and the CSS Sumter. It was during this scrum, multiple ships striking each other, that Colonel Ellet himself is going to be wounded. He's going to be shot in the knee, pistol ball to the knee, and this would turn out to be the only casualty for the Union of the Battle of Memphis. Now, Ellet's brother on the Monarch is going to go on to knock out the CSS Beauregard, knocks her out of action, and will actually run down the Confederate flagship, the Little Rebel, the CSS Little Rebel, before it could escape. By this point, Davis's ironclads are getting caught up, and we're making their presence known with their big guns. They're going to blow up the CSS Jeff Thompson and force what is left of the Confederate fleet to flee, kicking off a 10-mile chase down the river. Only one of the eight Confederate vessels escape, and that's the CSS Van Dorn. And she's actually going to be scuttled by her crew just a few days later when these ships begin to move down the water again and catch her at anchor. Now, at the end of the battle, the wounded Colonel Ellet sent his son, medical cadet Charles Rivers Ellet, into Memphis to receive the city's surrender. So picture this, guys. Young Ellet here is going to go into the city with just three guys protecting him, three of these soldiers off of the Ellet Rams. He's going to receive the surrender of the city, or at least a partial surrender of the city. The formal exchange occurs a little while later on, but he will then proceed to remove the Confederate colors from the post office and replace them with the national banner. While this is happening, a mob is going to actually gather and begin slinging stones at him and his comrades, as well as insults. A few accounts actually say pistols were fired at this party as well. Fortunately for him, Charles River Ellet will succeed in getting back to the ships. So he's not harmed in this, but it was definitely a harrowing thing for him to be doing. Unfortunately, the senior Charles Ellet was worse off than initially thought, and he was transferred to the Switzerland and sent back north in hopes that he would be able to recover, but sadly, he is going to pass away on June 21st, 1862. Colonel Charles Ellet Jr. passes away. His brother, Alfred Ellet, was promoted to command of the Ram Fleet, and later the entire Mississippi Marine Brigade, which, here's an interesting side note, the Mississippi Marine Brigade is not Navy, and it is Army, yet it's called the Marine Brigade, and they pull their soldiers from convalescing units and guys, so they wind up pissing everybody off. The Navy's mad about having ships and guys called Marines that are not actually under the Navy Department, and the Army's annoyed because these soldiers keep getting plucked out of hospitals and things to be placed on these ships. There'll eventually be a contingent of infantry, cavalry, and artillery involved with the Mississippi Marine Brigade. Charles Rivers Ellet will eventually be the commander of that infantry portion.
Matt, does the Veteran Reserve Corps show up out in the West? I know that by this time of the war, they're definitely showing up in the East. So right. They do not. Okay.
Right. Yeah, we don't have a Veteran Reserve Corps, or as they were known, the Invalid Corps initially, out in the Western Theater. These soldiers are convalescing at various hospitals throughout what we would now call the Midwest. And while they're there, recruiters or officers for the Marine Brigade are coming through and say, hey, boy, it sucks to have to march everywhere. Why don't you ride on a boat with us? And boy, does that sound nice. So a lot of these guys join up with the Marine Brigade. Now, like I said, Charles Rivers Ellet is going to become the commander of the infantry detachment, and Alfred Ellet will actually make Brigadier General and command the whole Mississippi Marine Brigade, as well as the Rams during the war. So this is a really fascinating unit that we don't hear much about. There was a really good book written by Chester Hearn. Sorry, I was just glancing down here at it. But Chester Hearn's book, The Strangest Outfit of All, a very fitting title. Highly recommend that if you're interested in this really niche portion of the war on the Western waters.
The battles on the water, the waterborne stuff of the war, are some of my favorite stuff. I get so jazzed every time you talk about it, Matt.
Oh, no, that's fantastic. This is tough stuff to top right here. This is you guys brought your A game for
sure.
Well,
I'm looking forward to what you've brought.
Well, let me pull this up right here. So, of course, I know both of you stuck with the Western theater, which is fantastic. I do think that the Western theater doesn't get enough coverage. But if I may, for a moment, take you to the bring attention to the easternmost battle fought during the time of the American Civil War. And so allow me to transport you to 1863 Japan during the time of the Shogun. Now, during this time, many of you, if you played the game Total War Shogun 2, Fall of the Samurai, you'll sort of know what sort of time period I'm talking about. But essentially right now, Japan does have an emperor, but who's more of a figurehead. Japan also has a shogun who's essentially the head warlord who's in charge of everything. And up until this time, they have been pursuing a policy of isolation, okay? In fact, many of the ships that they build are designed specifically not to leave the coast of Japan. If they do, they end up rudderless, they can end up destroyed. And in fact, some of the first Japanese people to land in America were castaways from such voyages. They weren't exactly immigrants traveling there on purpose. Of course, some of this changes with Commodore Perry. He comes over and he says, hey, it would behoove you to open up for foreign trade. The shogun.
And all these cannons are here to help you do that.
Absolutely. It's a great inspiration.
Yeah.
So the shogun realizes he can't fight the United States. So he does sort of open up his borders. He starts allowing Western books on mathematics, sciences, culture into the country. And this just ticks off the emperor. He feels that the shogun has turned his back on the Japanese people. And the emperor sends out an edict to expel foreigners from Japanese shores. Coincidentally, soon after that edict, the American consulate is burned down. Coincidence? It's a heck of a coincidence, I think. So one of the clans that takes this closest to heart is the Choshu clan. And they're the clan that has control of the Shimonoseki Straits. This is where foreign ships sail through when they're trading with Japan. And the Choshu have now set up batteries and fortified these straits to prevent foreign shipping from coming through this area. These straits are quite deadly. There's a lot of rocks in the water. And on both sides, there's great hills and ridges on which the Choshu install batteries, artillery batteries, to protect those straits. Ironically, they also purchased the Lancefield, Lanrick, and Daniel Webster ships, which were American-made. And so I find that very interesting that they did that. Of course, it's only a matter of time till this powder keg explodes. The Pembroke, which was an American merchant ship, travels onto the Shimonoseki Straits and is immediately attacked by the Choshu clan and their batteries. Lucky for them, they're able to escape with no loss of life, but that luck doesn't continue with the French and Dutch ships that sail through there soon after. They get hit by the Choshu batteries. They get heavily damaged. They lose some lives. And these guys are so trigger happy that they also fire on a Satsuma ship, which was actually an allied clan in Japan, but they mistaken it for a French ship and they fired on it anyway, and they sunk it. So these guys are not only trigger happy, they're getting really good at using their artillery. So let's quickly go back to the United States for a second here and go to Washington. Lincoln knows the eyes of the world are upon him, sort of like D-Day, right? They're wondering if this American experiment will survive its first real growing pains, okay? A lot of people don't think the Union will survive and aren't taking advantage of this civil war. Look at the French. They immediately move into Mexico. They start sending troops over there, putting up a puppet emperor. I do have a soft spot for Maximiliano, but that's what they do. But that's what they do. So this slight on American honor to go unpunished. And so he calls upon Captain David MacDougall. Captain David MacDougall is the right man for the job. He's a Mexican war veteran. He served in the blockade of Veracruz, and he commands the USS Wyoming. It's 190 feet long, 33 feet of beam. It drew 15 feet of water. It had Dahlgrens, four 32 pounders, and one 60 pounder Parrott rifle, steam powered. And it was in the Pacific hunting Confederate raiders before it was summoned to Japan, to the Shimonoseki Straits. So there it was, the USS Wyoming and Captain David MacDougall. They were there on July 16th, 1863. Now, I could tell you the story myself, but I think that the primary source is much better. And if I can just pull it up here, I'm going by the primary source of Joseph Hecko or Hecko. He actually was a interpreter for the American legation that was in Japan. He was Japanese born, and he was one of those castaways that when his ship sunk, he was rescued by an American ship and came to America as a castaway, learned English, and now is working for the American legation as an interpreter. And he happens to be on the USS Wyoming at this time. And he describes the battle that soon ensued. So he says, "So the captain gave the order, make ready for action. The big 64-pounder guns were at once run out and opened upon the batteries on shore. At precisely 10:50 a.m., we ran right in between the three Choshu vessels and treated them to a salute from our two Dahlgren guns. After delivering our broadside, we steamed slowly out, and crossing the bow of the steamer Lancefield, we worked towards the channel, pounding away at the enemy all the while. Meanwhile, the enemy kept up an unflagging fire from ships and batteries alike, but their aim was wild, and we noticed that the guns on shore were all fired trained upon the channel, and we passed so close under them that their shot mostly went 10 or 15 feet overhead. But it was not at all nice or comfortable to hear them whizzing and screaming aloft among our rigging. And the worst of it all was that there was no chance of falling back to the rear, for in a fight on a ship, there is no such convenient thing as the rear to fall back to. The steamer seemed to have some dignitaries on board, as we saw that there was the purple awnings with the prince's crest. As soon as we crossed Lancefield's bows, she slipped her cable and essayed to run for refuge into the inner harbor. At this instant, the captain called out to the gunner at the 11-inch Dahlgren to fire, but the gunner seemed to pay no attention until the captain had given the order for the third or fourth time. At last he did, as he was told, and bang went the gun with an ear-splitting crash. And as the smoke of the discharge drifted aside, we saw a great volume of smoke and steam hissing and pouring from the Lancefield's deck. And at the same time, she slewed slowly round and heeled over on one side. And in a minute or two, down she went into the waters. When we saw the steam pouring out of her, our tars gave three rousing cheers, fancying that the 11-inch shell had burst within her. And they heartened up wonderfully and went into the fight with all their soul, with all their strength, and all their mind. This lucky shot struck just at the right moment, but this time several of our men had been laid low or disabled by shot and flying bolts and splinters. The reason why the captain of the gun did not let loose at the first word of command was that he was taking aim at the exact waterline. And when he did fire, he hit the spot to a hair's breadth. He finished the vessel by that single well-directed shot. It tore through one side of the hull, ripped through the boilers, out the other side, and drove ashore and lodged there without ever bursting. This I learned from the Choshu officers afterwards. When we got out into the channel, we touched on a sunken rock, but by backing, we got off scatheless. While we were between three vessels, we stopped the engines and gave them broadside upon broadside. And so little did they like the fare we served up for them that we noticed many of their crews jumping overboard and escaping by swimming. Thus, we fought six batteries, a bark, a brig, and a steamer. We silenced all the batteries, and as for the brig and the steamer, we sank them. And all this was done in little more than one short hour. We ceased firing at 20 minutes after 12 p.m. During the engagement, we fired 53 shot and shell in all. With the results I have mentioned above, the Choshu men discharged 130 rounds in all, of which 22 did actual damage. This hit our rigging, smokestack, and hull and killed five and wounded seven of our men.
Wow.
So this was one heck of a fight. Wow. And, you know, Captain MacDougall, unfortunately, he doesn't receive any promotion. He doesn't really receive any fame. His engagement is eclipsed by, of course, Vicksburg and Gettysburg at the time.
yet he ensured that the honor of the United States was upheld on foreign shores. And my favorite president, Teddy Roosevelt, said of the engagement, had that action taken place at any other time than during the Civil War, its fame would have echoed all over the world.
There are two things I take away from that. One is people forget about the fact that almost there's no war that is singularly just like between one and two combatants. It is almost every war is an international affair. And our American Civil War shows up in Japan, it shows up in Mexico, and it shows up in France, and it shows up in England. And I think that it's really awesome because I think people are more or less familiar with the English and French connections. And sometimes people will know about the Battle of Palmito Ranch when, you know, that we kind of spill over the Rio Grande. But people almost never know about the fact that this war spilled over into Japan, in a sense. And so that's an awesome story. And then the other thing is like when you said that these guys, there is no rear. There is no place to go. There is no safe place. I think that people take lightly the violence of a naval or an aquatic or nautical style battlefield, whereas ships like ships of the line or ships taking fire from the land. But if you're standing on the deck of a ship and all hell is exploding around you, there is no real place for you to go. And that's why I think that movies like Master and Commander and the TV shows later like Black Sails really get this small detail right about it as far as just the damage that the shrapnel of the battle itself. These guys that are dying on these ship you're talking about are likely not even dying from the direct blast themselves, but like something is probably exploding and flying and taking them out. Piece of the hull, a piece of splinter, stuff like that. So those are my two points. Is one, people forget that even our Civil War is an international affair, and two, like the violence of an aquatic fight is always taken for granted. I guess people just don't really comprehend its nature. It's nasty. So I guess as we shift into my second story here, we should turn the lights down low and make sure that all the kids know our story. Now, there's not a ton of language in it, and I will absolutely not release anything with cursing. So if you hear me cursing, it'll be me. But I don't think I'm going to curse. But this story is a little bit naughty, which is why we got to pour ourselves a nice stiff drink, turn the lights down low. And I'm going to take you on a journey to Smashville, aka Nashville, aka Nashville, July of 1863. So our story directly begins in July of 1863, though. So however, though, a bit of context before we get there. Nashville's the state capital of Tennessee. It's the second biggest city in the state behind Memphis. So one, my story is also back in the West where, you know, as is often untold for Eastern theater stuff, we don't get into the West. So I'm going to stay in the West. And two, right as you were talking about, Matt, and your story talking about the fleet and the fall of Memphis, this story is sort of happening simultaneously and in the following weeks of that action. Some of the same groups of guys, some of the same command. If you really get into the structure, you'll see some of the same names between the two stories. However, Nashville is also the eighth largest city in the Confederacy as a whole, and it surrenders to Union forces early in February of 1862. It doesn't surrender early in February, but early in the war. You know, by February of 1862, we've really just kind of gotten going, but Confederate capitals are already falling. So as I said, it's the first Southern capital to fall during the war, and the events leading up to its surrender and occupation opened a vital gateway for the Union Army into the Southern Confederacy, as I had mentioned in my first story. So following the 1862 Battle of Shiloh, most of the significantly sized Confederate forces, they're going to abandon Tennessee until right around 1864. Cavalry under Nathan Bedford Forrest and John Hunt Morgan are going to remain in the area, and they're going to continue to harass and raid the federal garrisons and supply centers throughout 62, 63, and 64. And in response, the Nashville defensive network is going to be really built up. Think like the Civil War defenses of Washington. Forts, artillery placements, rifle pits, etc., things like that. And in Nashville, we're talking forts like Negley and Granger. So just remember, if you're hanging out in downtown Nashville and somebody's talking to you about a Civil War fort and you're thinking, oh, I'm in the South, this isn't a Confederate fort. Most of the forts you can go and visit today in Nashville and around Tennessee are Union fortifications that were built after the occupation of the Army there in 62. Now, as the summer turns into fall of 1862, you have Don Carlos Buell, the Army of the Ohio, is sort of occupying Nashville right now with a good number of guys. And this is a town that it's got people left in it, I guess you could say, like as happens in in all these pop culture movies or whatever, like the opposition army is coming, so people are going to flee, but not everybody flees. So there are people that remain in Nashville as the Army of the Ohio moves in. This city is no longer being supplied by the rest of the Confederacy, and the Union isn't going out of its way to supply all of these people who are not thrilled for them to be there. So resources are going to run low, and law and order is going to start breaking down around the city, as I said, as these resources dry up. And in October of 1862, Major General William Rosecrans is going to exacerbate things by moving in his Army of the Cumberland into Nashville. He's going to bring 50,000 guys with him. So, like I said, the resources are already strained. The Army of the Ohio is already there. There's 50,000 men coming in now with the Army of the Cumberland in addition. And this influx of men is just going to create all sorts of headaches for the Union command structure. But there was one particular headache that is especially worth talking about during this time. So, Paul, I will ask you, what is the world's oldest profession?
Oh, that's a tough one. It's got to be prostitution there, huh?
It is 1,000,000% prostitution. Bingo. So the prostitute population of Nashville, Tennessee prior to the war was somewhere right around 200 women of the night. And by 1863, at the time the Army of the Cumberland is marching into town, there are more than 1,500 prostitutes in Nashville, and this number is going to continue kind of growing. Furthermore, they can all be found in one spot in this single 3/4 mile stretch of town that is known as the Smoky Row. So, yeah. So you have an army moving into town, and it's becoming stationary for the first time in a while. You have things like downtime, back pay is catching up to these guys, and coupled with the fact that there isn't much to do in a town that really doesn't want you there to begin with. Because remember, Nashville is not one of these weird Virginia border towns or Maryland border towns that could go either way. And maybe you see Unionist sentiments in Virginia or whatever. Like, we're talking Tennessee. We're talking Nashville. This is a southern town. And they don't care about these Yankees occupying their city. So these soldiers don't have a lot to do. And these 1,500 women or so quickly become one of the only, but certainly a favorite endeavor of the soldiers. So what is the headache then? Well, idle time in most situations, whether in the army or not, creates an opportunity for mischief. And these soldiers are going to get mischievous. These soldiers are drinking. They're getting rowdy in town. They're having dust-ups with the locals. But the real big headache is the venereal disease that's running rampant through the ranks of the Army of the Cumberland. Syphilis?
Worse than a chlamydia? College campus.
Yeah, exactly, right? Think about every frat boy. Now you have an army of frat boys. The Union Army of Frat Boys is occupying Nashville. But you have syphilis, you have chlamydia, you have gonorrhea. They're afflicting these soldiers at an exponential rate. And you might ask, well, why is this a headache? Well, some of the symptoms of these afflictions are pain in your abdomen, in your pelvis, in your testicles, high fevers, strong fatigue, among a lot of other ailments that are going to seriously hinder the ability of someone to be very active, much less do fatigue duty, like building up these forts, or more importantly, fighting, because this is a war. Now, like I said, Nashville is a major Confederate capital, and it fell early in the war. So imagine the symbolism of taking the city, of retaking the city, rather. What if a sizable Confederate force threatened the city, and then a third or half of the army, the Union army that is down with BD, and they're unable to defend? I was like, now this presents a couple what-ifs. And if you don't know how I feel about what-ifs and what-if scenarios, let me break it down for you real quick. What-ifs are a lot of fun. Or they can be fun, but they're also real dangerous, and often following the train of thought down the rabbit hole takes us far and sometimes very far from fact, reality, the historical record, whatever. And it's the facts in the historical record that really matter the most. So exercise your what-ifs carefully. So to proactively address this growing concern, Brigadier General James D. Morgan, who's in command out at Murfreesboro, is going to order Provost Marshal George Spaulding, Colonel George Spaulding, to come up with a solution. Matt, kind of explain to me real quick why it's Morgan that issues these, because my understanding is that it's actually General Granger who's in command of the District of Nashville and the Middle Tennessee. So why does this order come from Murfreesboro and Morgan?
Right. Granger is absolutely in charge of Nashville, but Morgan had been in charge there first. And Morgan actually predates his commission by 2 months over Granger. So even though they're both brigadier generals, they're both commanding division scale forces, Morgan is actually the higher ranked of the two. And so he had actually begun this process of trying to figure out a way to deal with the venereal disease and the prostitution in Nashville prior to him being shifted over to Murfreesboro. And so he just is making sure the job is getting done prior to his leaving and immediately thereafter.
So Morgan's the guy who issues the orders, and they finally get the ball rolling on what they're going to do about this. And the solution is pretty simple. Let's just remove all the prostitutes from the city. Sounds easy, right? Well, we'll just round them up and we'll take them out of here. Except while we're laughing, this is actually the plan that Spalding comes up with. Like, he's just going to round them up and get them out of here. So prior to landing here, they've tried to arrest them. They threatened to arrest them, you know, things like that. And this did very little to discourage the women's work. And so this literal roundup and drop off is ordered. And believe it or not, this was actually attempted earlier in the year on a smaller scale, albeit, but it proved ineffective. The prostitutes, they were taken just outside the city limits. And they're going to be kind of just dropped off. Like, imagine like a cartoon. Somebody drops you just to the other side of a sign, drops you off. And then they're like, don't come back. So what do you think the women did?
They came back.
They just came back. Right. Good job. You took them so far. So they just came back. So how would Spalding be approaching this task in July of 1863, having already tried this thing? Well, easy. We'll take them further than the city limits. A lot further. Louisville, Kentucky. So up the river. Out of jurisdiction, out of state, out of sight, and out of mind. Not our problem anymore. That's sort of how they're done to do this. Like, quite literally, they're just kicking this one, like, down the road, but, like, up the river. They're just making this somebody else's problem.
Modern problem, modern solution, you know?
Exactly. <That's right>. Spalding's a genius. So to accomplish this, Colonel Spalding, he's going to requisition the use of a side-wheeled steamship named the Idaho. Which is captained by a veteran riverboatman named John Newcomb. Now, real quick, John Newcomb is a civilian. He's not in the military. His title as captain is not a military rank. So think like Captain Smith of the Titanic or the captain of the Love Boat or whatever. Like, it's just, he owns the boat, so he's the captain of it. You know, he's not in the military. So while we're talking about colonels and generals and lieutenants and captains, he's not a military guy. So as expected, you know, the ship gets requisitioned and Newcomb is not happy to see his ship commandeered. And he becomes especially pissed off when he learns of the sordid nature of his passengers. Newcomb filed numerous official complaints, basically worried that his ship, his name, and his reputation would all be besmirched and he would become no more or less or be associated as the floating whorehouse. So Newcomb's real happy right now. And so Spalding is going to get these complaints or his office or whatever, but basically they are unmoved by these complaints that Newcomb's filing. And he orders between 110 and 150 prostitutes to be boarded onto the Idaho, which an aptly named ship, and sent up the river.
I'm glad you said that because I was thinking it.
It's all about timing and delivery. And like, you know, when I was writing this out, I was like, I don't want to say the joke right away because it just, you know, you got to get it in later. So yeah, but I mean, ridiculous. We're putting a bunch of prostitutes on a ship called Idaho. So, can't make this stuff up, folks. This is history right here. So they're boarded onto the boat and they're sent up the river to Louisville. And just to sort of tell you what this scene is like, right? So like I told you about the city limits scene, Spalding is going to have all these women ushered down to the docks and they're going to be put on these ships and they're going to be sent off. And Spalding and company are waving, and no Union soldiers are boarding the ships to keep order or service guards. The ship is sailing off, and Spalding's like, bye, see ya, we're done, and that's it. And suddenly it's Newcomb and a whole bunch of these girls and, like, maybe a few of Newcomb's crew on the ship, but, like, that's it. It's no longer Spalding or the Union Army's problem. And these women, by the way, they're pissed, which we'll get to in a minute here, but there's a problem that exists for Newcomb now. And it's a problem that actually exists today in our super invasive digital world. So it's not actually a problem that is super unique to us, which we often think it is, considering the case of the digital age we live in. But the case is simple, that news travels faster than transportation, especially 1860s steamships. And this is the case for Spalding, Newcomb, and his passengers of ill repute. So Louisville is aware of this impending arrival of women. And they're like, no thanks. Nope. Not having it. Don't bring the prostitutes here. We don't want them. And they send a huge contingent of their police force down to the docks to meet this ship as it comes in to dock. And they're there to basically send signals that say, hey, you're not offloading. So they're sent there to prohibit Nukem from docking. Whether you dock or not, you're not offloading here, buddy. So if you pull up to the dock, great. Great to see you. You're not getting off the ship, you or anybody. So Nukem's like, all right, now what do I do? And so he sends message to Spaulding. He says, this is what's up. You know, I'm sort of getting, you know, blackballed here by the police. And Louisville is saying, I can't do this. And so Spaulding's like, got a great idea. Go further. So the Idaho and the women of the night are all going to be continuing up the Tennessee. I don't know if it's Tennessee. It's definitely the Cumberland Rivers and one other river. They're going to head, maybe it's the Ohio, Cumberland and Ohio Rivers. Right, because they end up next in Cincinnati. And same thing, scene repeats itself. The police force is aware. They're like, no, 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 no. You know, they shut it down before the boat's able to dock. And so they rinse and repeat this attempt. They just keep getting further and further out. They try to dock. It doesn't work. They try to dock. It doesn't work. And eventually, Nukem, like most rational people that have tried and failed at something a bajillion times, they're just going to give up. And he's tired of this. He doesn't want to be doing this anyway. You know, he didn't sign up for this. Essentially, the government told him, this is what you're doing with your boat. And so now it's not working. He says, screw that. So he's going to turn around. He's going to head back to Nashville. The end, right? Not even. Firstly, Nukem was basically only in charge of the steamer itself. And that was about it. The Union Army had borrowed, and for those of you listening on a podcast, because this is not a video, you can't see me air quoting, but I'm putting borrowed in quotes, because you know how the Army requisitions things. They just say, hey, thanks for that. We'll talk about compensation later, maybe. So,
thank you for your patriotism.
Yeah, exactly, right? Do your duty. So Newcomb's in this position, and so his ship and his passengers, they're his passengers especially, they're very unruly. And as I said, right, like in this situation where the ship is being borrowed and Nukem is pissed, the thing that we haven't really touched on here is the women that are pissed, because when they are put on this boat, they're put on against their will. Like they're not being asked, hey, do you want to leave the city? You know, these women are making pretty good income. I don't really know a lot about the lifestyle of a prostitute in the mid-1860s, but I would surmise that with an army in town, they're living as comfortably as they're going to live in that kind of environment because of the consistency of income and clientele. So business is good. Why the hell would I leave? Kind of thing. So they're not happy to have been put on this boat. And once they're put on this boat, the conditions aren't great. There's 150-ish women crammed onto a steamer that's probably rated for about 80 to 90 with people. And the facilities are going to start failing. The plumbing backs up, stuff like that. There's really bad food rations. You know, like Nukem wasn't planning for all this. So his ship wasn't totally prepared to handle all this. So the women, the crew, himself, like not everybody's getting fed all the right stuff. The medical care on the ship is really crappy. And like people do when they're highly stressed out and they're blowing off steam a lot, they get kind of destructive. And John Newcomb's ship is going to take a beating at the hands of these prostitutes. They're going to be breaking furniture. There's going to be holes in the wall, mirrors, lamps, pictures, ornamentation is going to be damaged or destroyed. When the Idaho docks back in Nashville on August 3rd, 1860, is going to immediately start absolutely badgering the quartermasters in Nashville. And later he has to go right to the War Department for restitution and compensation because of the time that he invested and the damages he accrued to his ship. And to wrap up his story, Nukem specifically, it'll take him 2 years. But in a letter that was sent in October 1865 from the Treasury Department, Captain Nukem is going to be awarded a little over $5,000. I believe the exact sum is $5,316.04, which is almost the entire amount he asked for. And before I finish with him, the ship itself, the Idaho, he's going to sink. Nine, the Idaho itself is going to sink. So the ship's story ends at the bottom of a waterway somewhere, some river here in the United States. And Nukem, we have to assume that he's happy with his settlement because there is no appeal. And Nukem more or less fades into the obscurity of antiquity. There is nothing else significant as far as the war, and we really only have his family history if you get into the genealogy of the Nukem family as far as like relevance. But our story isn't ending here with Captain John Newcomb's involvement. Remember, he was unsuccessful in offloading his prostitute passengers. And in fact, quite the opposite. He brought them right back to Nashville. So that brings the Union command, as well as all of us, the observers, with the women who potentially compromised the army. At this point, General Morgan, General Granger, who by now has been involved, and Provost Marshal Colonel Spaulding, they're all exasperated. They, you know, the army's getting sicker, and they can't figure out what to do about this. The town isn't going to help them, kind of thing. So they look. They tried to take them rather outside the city limits. That didn't work. They came right back. They tried to ship them away, quite literally out of state. That didn't work. They came right back. Arresting them didn't work. So what do you do? So the answer for these guys really lay in the mentality of, if you can't beat them, join them. So that's exactly the approach that the Union Army is going to, or the Union Army of the Cumberland, rather. I shouldn't make it seem like the whole Union Army is doing this. Specifically, the Union Army of the Cumberland in Nashville, Tennessee is going to do this. But they're going to adopt this sort of, if you can't beat them, join them approach. And Provo Order number 21 is going to require that all of Nashville's prostitutes are going to report to the marshal's office by the 20th of August
for a medical examination and licensing.
For those not clear on what that means, it means the legalization and regulation of the sex trade in Nashville, Tennessee, right in the middle of the American Civil War. So the Army is going to organize both Army and civilian medical personnel in several testing locations to conduct these examinations. Remember, there are over 1,500 prostitutes in Nashville. So Newcomb's expedition was only the first attempt at offloading them. So he only has about 150. So when he brings them back, it's not like he brought back all of them. He just brought back some. The rest are still here. So getting this big operation set up and executing it, it's going to take some time. So the initial examinations and licensing costs for each woman is going to cost $5. And if they're greenlit to offer their wares, they're going to be required to be re-examined once every 10 days at the cost of $1 each for examinations. They were going to be sent to specially designed hospitals that were established and paid for with the exam and licensing fees that were being paid for by all the women, the madams, and like the pimps. So a couple things here real quick. One, this wasn't a federal money grab. $5 was a lot of money at that time, but the responsible use of the monies towards the medical facilities for the women, it kind of just illustrates a lack of nefariousness. He's like that. It just wasn't cheap. So in an area where, again, the local populace isn't going to help you, and let's be real, folks, the federal government's not going to just give you money to pay for, you know, a bunch of hookers kind of thing. Like, although I wonder if political people have ever paid for hookers before. Scandal. You know, the reality is like that they're just not going to pay for that. So this money to pay for all these operating expenses has got to come from somewhere. So essentially, the women are now self-funding their business and their licensing and their medical care. Two, the women were never sent to these hospitals against their will. So unlike the 150 or so who were rounded up and thrown on Newcomb's boat and attempt to be shipped out of town, the women that are being sent to these hospitals are going more or less gratefully. I don't know if gratefully, I shouldn't put that in their mouth or in those words, but like willingly, they're not being dragged there against their will in most cases, because they're going there for such conditions after these exams like pregnancy and venereal disease. And for most of the women, A, they need the medical care and the treatments, and B, this was for many the first and only opportunity to get some of the most modern and advanced medical care of the time. So there's a lot of people willing to go because a lot of the ailments they're feeling don't feel great. If we get a chance to fix it and stop it, hell yeah. Three, the women who did refuse to comply with the exam and licensing order and were found to be continuing their work were arrested and sent to labor houses for a minimum of 30 days. And labor houses did a ton of tasks from just local resource-related stuff for the town to sometimes Rosie the Riveter-style things that helped in the production of war materials and stuff like that. But essentially, they were sent to an in-house labor camp where it was like, you're, you know, basically going to work jail. And four, and perhaps most importantly, considering the original problem of venereal disease in the Union Army of the Cumberland and the Army's objective of reducing or eliminating the invisible enemy, the legalization and regulation of the sex trade in Nashville in 1863, guys, it works. The Army gets a lot healthier. The venereal disease rates, they drop. The morale is way up. Work is getting done efficiently. Like, these forts are built very fast. The defensive networks, the positioning and placements is up. And the fighting readiness is maintained. And the city, in 1864, rather, and when the Confederates come back, like I was saying, because remember, they had abandoned for a while. In 1864, when the Confederates come back and they attack at Franklin and later at Nashville, the boys in the Union Army are in really good fighting shape. And then if you pair that with the really good defenses, the resoundingness of the victories that they achieved in those battles, the fact that they routed John Bell Hood's Army of Tennessee, and the fact that this kind of ends large-scale fighting in the West, the end of John Bell Hood's essential effectiveness period, not just like his destructiveness, like his career is essentially over. You know, I think this is his last command that he holds. I know there's some political beef with him, but more or less, like, the fighting at Franklin and Asheville is it for John Bell Hood as far as the American Civil War. And as I close, like, all of this stuff comes right back to the what ifs.
So what if the Union soldiers in the area were sick or in less than stellar fighting shape when Hood and his grizzled, battle-hardened Confederates showed up? You know, fortunately, we don't really have to have that conversation unless you want to just really have some fun over a couple drinks, because the way it played out, it was an exclamation point on the various accomplishments of the Union armies in the Western theater. But had things been different, who's to say that a period would even been put on the sentence on the action in the West? Perhaps the war drags on longer out there. Perhaps the war shifts and it requires or draws more time, energy, focus, and resources in a way so much that it affects the war in the East. See, rabbit holes can get deep really fast. They're like quicksand, right? You're usually in too far before you realize you're stuck and you're off track. So that's all I got, right? You know, the unique, albeit not so unique, problem for the Union Army solved with an unconventional approach. And for all my super stuffy friends and listeners, or anyone out there with a super closed mind, just remember, guys, like, it worked. You can make a case that it made an impact on the greater good for all in that area at the time. So I don't think that that's a story you hear in a lecture at a college in a textbook. And I highly doubt your dad, your mom, or grandpa or grandma told you that one at the table. Yeah. So we could turn the lights back up now if you want, because Civil War late night is over. Oh, but the Union Army was getting a little naughty there, you know, in 63 out West, and they got sick.
You know, that's fantastic. And there's a couple of things I love about that story is, one, it's neat that you talk about sort of like a public health issue, especially what's going on today and everything. So that's pretty relevant. And two, a lot of people don't realize logistics of how to move people, get them to a certain location, feed them, care for them, and then ensure that their shenanigans doesn't cause them to be inactive in battle. So, you know, that is a huge issue for generals of the day. And so it's
people
something that we often
overestimate the amount of downtime soldiers of both sides of this war have. Yeah. I mean, they meet, they fight, and then they break apart. And when they break apart, there is a ton of downtime. They're not always set up in these huge winter camps, but sometimes they go weeks sitting in one spot. And you can only drill so much, you know? When the drill's over, what are you doing? Sometimes you get bored with just going back and sleeping. Sometimes you get so used to the grind, you're like, all right, well, now that work's done for the day, what are we getting into here, Matt? You know, and Matt's like, so my friend Matt has way too much class to go to the Smoky Row.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, Pat, because one of the quotes that comes out of that story is that supposedly one of these guys wrote that no one becomes a soldier until they've gone through Smoky Row.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it. That's fantastic.
Now, we've done a bunch of stories in the Western theater, and in the case of yours, Paul, in the very far East, but we're going to bring things back to the Eastern theater of the war for my last story, and we're going to talk a little bit about the USCT, the United States Colored Troops, at Monocacy. As I mentioned in our opener, I'm fortunate enough to work at Monocacy National Battlefield outside of Frederick, Maryland. Known as the battle that saved Washington, this was a delaying action that slowed General Jubal Early's advance on Washington, D.C. during the third Confederate invasion of the North in the summer of 1864. But we are not going to be talking about that fight tonight, okay? We're actually going to be talking about another aspect of Monocacy Junction. Come to find out, Monocacy Junction, the railroad junction beside the Monocacy River, has an important role to play in the United States Colored Troops, or the USCT, as they were known. As we know, on January 1st, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln changed the very focus of the Civil War itself from preserving the Union to preserving the Union and destroying slavery in the United States. He will do this with his Emancipation Proclamation. This was important not just to freeing enslaved individuals in Confederate-controlled portions of the country, but also for allowing and encouraging African-American men to enlist. Now, the Navy had been enlisting African-Americans for years, even into the Civil War years, but the Army had not allowed it. There was some experimentation in 1862 after the Second Confiscation Act with trying to get some African-American units online, but this does not get real heavy federal support until the Emancipation in 1863. With the USCT coming online, there was a need for a way to enlist these men. That meant recruiting stations. Now, today is May 20th. And on May 22nd, 1863, so 157 years in 2 days from now, the United States Colored Troops was established by the War Department General Orders Number 143. This order not only set up a bureau within the War Department for the USCT, but it authorized the development of recruiting stations. One such station was Monocacy Junction outside of Frederick, Maryland. Now, what's interesting about Monocacy Junction is that it actually had a long history with slavery in Maryland and in this part of the country. We have, of course, multiple farms surrounding Monocacy Junction, all of which were slaveholder long before the Civil War. In fact, we have the second largest slaveholding population or enslaved population in Frederick County in the early 19th century at a farm known as La Hermitage, better known as the Best Farm. That was its name during the Battle of Monocacy. But La Hermitage had upwards to 90 enslaved individuals on it at one point. This was a big quasi-plantation. Now, the junction itself, the railroad junction, would actually be utilized by Frederick Militia, three companies of the city militia that would be organized and thrown onto trains to head down to Harper's Ferry during John Brown's raid in 1859. And of course, that raid, the purpose of it is to try to incite some sort of servile insurrection in the South by Brown and his followers. So all these interesting ties to slavery right here in Central Maryland. Now, for the recruiting station that gets developed there at Monocacy Junction, one of the recruiting officers that was active in this part of Maryland was a gentleman by the name of Colonel Krieger. And Krieger is going to let it be known in the Frederick Examiner, one of the local papers, that, quote, "I have no authority or right as to ask a Negro whether he is a slave or a free man. And after he is sworn, I have no power to release him," end quote. Now, he is going to go on to add something of an end note to this, if you will, stating, quote, "I would advise slaves not to put their names down," end quote. Okay, but still, to have somebody say in the paper, "Hey, I'm not going to ask him if he's enslaved or free, and once he's in, he's in." That was a very big deal. And as you might expect, that does not go over well with everyone here in Maryland. Now, Maryland is, of course, a border state. The emancipation has been issued, but it does not affect the border states. Slavery at that time was still legal in Maryland and remained so until November 1st, 1864, after a new state constitution outlawing the practice of slavery would be voted upon. And that constitution barely passes. It passes primarily because of the soldiers' vote, but it would pass after a vote in October and goes into effect on November 1st, 1864. So from May 22nd, 1863 to November 1st, 1864, hundreds of African Americans are going to enlist throughout Maryland, many of them at Monocacy Junction itself, while Maryland still upheld slavery at the time. In fact, the farm on which Monocacy Junction abuts had slaves, just like I mentioned. The Best Farm during the fight in 1864 has a number of slaves on it. All the farms in the immediate vicinity of the junction are still slaveholding at this time. There is some evidence that some of these enslaved individuals even enlisted at Monocacy Junction. We're still trying to hash out all those details, but it is believed that two individuals from one of these nearby farms actually will enlist in the United States Colored Troops right there at Monocacy Junction. We do not have any evidence, though, if they had been allowed to, and their masters are receiving $300 from the federal government, which is how much they would be paid for having their enslaved individual enlist in the service, or if these gentlemen enlisted themselves as a way to escape bondage. Now, at this point, just the USCT troops that have enlisted, we've got about 540 names and various regiments that they joined identified. There's also over 100 enslaved individuals for the farms, but if we're talking about just the United States Colored Troops, we've got 540 of them identified. This includes guys that are going to go into famous African-American regiments, such as the 54th and 55th Massachusetts, the famed regiments that were highlighted there in the movie Glory. And of course,
give them hell, 54!
That's right. And of course, the famed 4th United States Colored Troops, which is going to recruit heavily in Maryland, as well as regiments that have far less renown, such as, but no less importance, I should say, such as the 11th United States Colored Heavy Artillery. We never hear about the Colored Heavy Artillery units, but they did exist. And the 11th is, the 3rd, 8th, and 11th would actually recruit a number of men right out of Monocacy Junction. The work on identifying the enslaved of the various farms at Monocacy National Battlefield, as well as the United States Colored Troop soldiers that passed through Monocacy Junction, is ongoing and is just one of many stories that we have only begun to scratch the surface of at Monocacy National Battlefield. And the reason I wanted to touch on it today is because it's not only an ongoing story, but it's one of these things that has been more or less ignored for much of our history of the American Civil War, and the National Park Service and other organizations are trying to bring those stories to light. Pat's done a lot of work with us at Monocacy as a living history presenter, but he's also been a researcher as well for us. Not as much fun as the Idaho and Pat's story there, but definitely one of interest and one that I wanted to bring to everyone's attention. So,
Matt, one of the things that I think, if I'm not, correct me if I'm wrong, the USCT infantry, heavy artillery, cavalry, artillery, all that stuff, they don't get like an enlistment point in like every state. They only get a few of these places for the entire Union. So it's not just African American men from Maryland that are signing up at Monocacy Junction. I understand when we did our 1864 project, like we were reading some of the names of the people that enlisted there, and they were coming from places up like where you're from, like Michigan,
right.
Wisconsin,
there is a
Minnesota. Yeah,
exactly,
like
right, Pat. There have been a handful of folks that have been identified from other states. Most of the folks at Monocacy Junction that go through Monocacy Junction were Marylanders. We're African Americans from various points of Maryland, and some of them are coming from way out in the western part of the state. But you're absolutely right. There is a gentleman who comes down from Detroit, enlists at Monocacy Junction, and I believe they send him off to the 54th Mass, if I remember right. So there are a number of folks coming from all over the place because there is only a limited number of enlisting locations for the United States Colored Troops. That's what was excellent.
Yeah, Matt's doing some great work. So if you guys are ever in the area and can get over to CMAT at Monocacy, you know, don't just ask about the battle. The battle was also amazing, but that battlefield also has a complete other history that you might not otherwise connect with if you're really just looking for the big bang and boom that happened there in 64.
Oh, yeah. I love that story. I love the fact that personally, my knowledge on USCTs is very limited. So that's why I really like that story. It's something I have to brush up on. And also, too, I love that we're getting it right from the source. Right there from, you know, Monocacy itself right there. So
yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
I love when you tell USCT stories out of Monocacy, buddy. That was absolutely awesome. So I guess we're coming to the end here, right, Paul? So Paul, take us home, brother.
All right. Let me close this out with my final story here. So what inspired me to do this story is that I feel that we all know the story of the 11th New York or the 72nd Pennsylvania. These were two regiments in the Civil War that were raised primarily by fire departments in New York and I believe Philadelphia, respectfully. So what we don't necessarily hear about is the story of the Metropolitan Police Department in the Civil War. The Metropolitan Police Department, today known as the NYPD, very close to home
because I live here in New York City.
So just to paint a picture for you, the NYPD back during that time really was a motley crew of individuals. They did not go by the European standard. These guys smoked cigars. They usually had spit and tobacco, and they were some rough guys. If anyone has seen the movie Gangs of New York and know of the Dead Rabbits, the story of the 40 Thieves, the Bowery Boys, imagine having to be a cop, put on a block, and told, this is your corner, address your conditions on this corner, and you had to face up against Bill the Butcher. And these are the type of guys that joined the Metropolitan Police Department and did that sort of thing.
Well, if you ever
every
Detective
day.
Corcoran in the TV show Copper, you could handle Bill
the absolutely.
Butcher.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Love that show.
Corcoran, Corky was the man.
Yes, absolutely. I don't know what happened to that show, but they got to bring it back.
It was too good, so they canceled it. That's all that happened.
Well, and exactly, and especially with that show, you can see that even though they were a rough bunch of guys, they were professionals. They knew their craft. They even had a detective department or bureau, and they often operated in plain clothes undercover. So there's three stories. I know I'm cheating here, but there are three points or stories I'd like to cover. The first point I'd like to make is that the NYPD, excuse me if I use Metropolitan Police and NYPD interchangeably, but the NYPD goes on to save Abraham Lincoln early on in the war, thereby allowing him to command and lead the Union to victory. The second point is that the NYPD is there when the first shots are fired and respond to the slight on the American flag in Charleston. And finally, in the NYPD today, there are traditions that date back to the Civil War that are continued up until this day. So big claims. Let's see if I can fill those big boots, big claims.
I do a lot of work in Manassas. So I know there are firefighters in Manassas for sure.
Right. So, you know, we got to hear about the police officers. So Let me take you to February 1861. Abraham Lincoln has been elected. And of course, he has to travel to Washington City at the time. But by traveling by train, he has to travel through Baltimore. And he has gotten wind of a plot to assassinate him, potentially. There is no Secret Service at the time. So who can he turn to that can help protect him? Well, there's Ward Hill Lehman. This is a man that has been his confidant since his lawyer days, and in fact has been a self-proclaimed bodyguard. He later on sleeps in front of Lincoln's room with revolver and knife at hand in the executive mansion.
He's a big boy.
Yes, absolutely. One of the only few people that could challenge Lincoln in height.
Yeah.
And of course, then there's Alan Pinkerton, who runs his private detective agency, who is famous or infamous as McClellan's spymaster, but would gain fame hunting down the likes of Jesse James and so on after the war.
More the latter. Not the Jesse James part. Infamy.
Yes. And of course, he could turn to the Metropolitan Police Department, the NYPD, because they were at the time probably the most organized law enforcement agency in the country. And they responded to the call. They sent two detectives, their best detectives, Thomas Sampson and Eli DeVoe. They sent them to Baltimore to uncover this plot. The two detectives would join a secesh militia group in Baltimore, and they would do some investigating. And sure enough, they would find that if there was no plot to particularly assassinate Lincoln, there's definitely a plot to promote disunion in the nation. But of course, their investigation triggers a lot of suspicion with their comrades within the militia. They've decided they've gained enough intel, so they escape to Washington City. Now, here's the problem. When they get to Washington City and they sign in the guest log, they use the same aliases that they've been using in Baltimore. I don't know why they did it. Even in their writings, they say, we can't figure out why we made that mistake, because the next morning when they wake up and walk into the lobby, they see those secesh militia who are suspicious of them waiting in the Willard's lobby, going through that logbook, and finally they stop at those names, look at each other knowingly, and they know they're out to get them. Lucky for them, or weirdly enough, one of those secesh pulls Sampson, Detective Sampson, aside and says, follow me outside. Sampson follows him outside. He's got his hand on the trigger of his pocket revolver. He's not sure who this man is or what he's about. But the man identifies himself. He's Timothy Webster, a buddy of theirs from the NYPD previous years and also currently a detective Pinkerton. For the Pinkerton Detective Agency. Right. And he does have an unfortunate outcome later in the war operating as a spy. But he tells them, look, you guys are in deep trouble. They're out to get you. They're going to kill you. You need to get out of here. What I like about that is it really shows that, one, the world of intelligence back then, even today, is a very small world. People know of each other. And also, two, spies are literally tripping over each other in Washington. So he tells them, you got to get out of there. He leads them to a train to head back to New York City. Of course, luck is just not with these guys. While they're on the train heading back to New York City, they notice that these secesh militiamen are on the train going car to car looking for him. They've got to jump for it. So they jump from the speeding train. Detective DeVoe sprains his ankle so badly, he nearly passes out. But they see no one jump after them, so they think, okay, we're in the clear. They hop on a horse car, and they're headed back out of there towards New York City. And of course, again, their luck fails them. The car stops. The driver tells them, this is the last stop, time to get off. And where have they stopped? They've stopped in Baltimore
in front of the secesh militia's headquarters.
Luckily, there's no one there. They get to a cab. They take a cab up to New York City. They give their report to their commanding officer. And Lincoln passes through Baltimore unaccosted. So you could argue that through their efforts and through their daring deeds and bad luck, they were able to save Lincoln as he passed through Baltimore. But I also made another claim that the NYPD was there during the first shots that were ever fired. So Lincoln comes to Washington and the Civil War ensues. Major Anderson at Fort Sumter seemingly finds himself in enemy territory and besieged overnight with the secession of South Carolina. There's no Facebook. There's no email. There's nothing like that back then. And so Not even a carrier pigeon. So the person who probably cares most about Major Anderson at this point in his career is his wife. His wife wants to go to Charleston to find out how Major Anderson is doing. Of course, she can't go alone. She knows that it's best to travel in pairs, and it's best to team up with somebody who knows a little bit about danger. And she recalls that back in the day, Major Anderson, from his Mexican War days, would often talk about a Sergeant Peter Hart who served with him. I like to think if we've seen the movie We Were Soldiers, the relationship between Hal Moore, Mel Gibson, and Sam Elliott, Sergeant Major Plumley, this was the relationship Major Anderson had with Sergeant Peter Hart. She looks up Sergeant Peter Hart and, of course, finds out that he is out of the Army, but he is a New York City police officer. She calls on Peter Hart, asks him, are you willing to go down to Charleston to go see your friend, my husband, and to see that everything is all right? And he agrees. They make it to Charleston, and there is a tearful reunion. But it is very clear that the violence is about to erupt. And so Mrs. Anderson, she heads out. And interestingly enough, Peter Hart, Sergeant Peter Hart, he has no dog in the fight. He's left the military. He doesn't have to stay here. He can go back to his job in New York City as a police officer. But he has a brotherhood with Major Anderson that was formed in combat. Some would say that that brotherhood is closer than blood. And he chooses to remain behind at Fort Sumter. The siege begins at 4 a.m. on April 12, 1861. Lieutenant Farley fires his cannon and an orange glow illuminates Fort Sumter for 13 seconds, and the bombardment begins. At one point, the flag takes a direct hit, and Peter Hart climbs the fort's walls to nail Old Glory to a spar to keep it flying. Echoes of Fort McHenry sort of, and the flag was still there, if you will. Of course, Anderson is forced to surrender, and Peter Hart and the rest of Anderson's command are evacuated to New York City, where they take part in the greatest war rally in New York City, which was my first episode for the podcast. And during that rally, they put up the Sumter flag for all to see. And
policeman Peter Hart is asked to speak, and he says,
I see many patriotic hearts around me, which we would have rejoiced to have with us at Fort Sumter. This, pointing to the flag, is a flag that we nailed to the flagstaff of Fort Sumter, and nobly we defended it until the last. I want you of New York to volunteer to nail that flag again to Fort Sumter. I think it's interesting he says that because by the end of the war, when Anderson is invited back to Fort Sumter to raise the Sumter flag again over the fort, Peter Hart is invited and he is there with him.
Wow.
So there you have the New York City Police Department again there at Fort Sumter. Going on from there, just closing out, of course, I would like to give a quick shout out to Sergeant Donald Boyle of the Mounted Unit of NYPD for helping me out with this. I went straight for the source for this stuff. So to just give you an idea, at the end of the Civil War in New York City, I don't know if there was rioting under the influence was a thing, but people were committing crimes and riding off on horseback. They were racing. So what they did was they scoured the NYPD for former cavalrymen who had fought in the Civil War. And these 300 cavalrymen would form the Mounted Unit of NYPD. They brought many traditions with them that are still used today in the NYPD. They brought the yellow stripe down the pants to designate the cavalry. They wore the cross saber. They still wear the cross sabers as their insignia.
The saddles, up until 10 years ago, were McClellan saddles. And Sergeant Boyle tells me he actually learned how to ride on that saddle, and he assures me that the upgrade was much needed since the saddle was pretty uncomfortable for both rider and horse.
But the bridles are still the same from the Civil War. Also, the manuals they have as far as training for using horses for crowd control, maneuvers, and also care of the horses.
All of that dates back to the Civil War manuals.
Like I said, they originally formed up to deal with reckless galloping. But of course, they were formed up later on and used because if you look at Manhattan back in the day, it's all city now, but back in the day, Upper Manhattan was actually farmland. And a lot of criminals would commit crimes and then go uptown. And sort of John Wayne-esque, the NYPD would mount their horses and go uptown to go catch these guys and bring them back downtown. After that, the NYPD Mounted Unit would go into a community affairs role. Everyone loves the 10-foot cop, very picturesque, very photogenic. But this officer on a horse can see a lot more than an officer on foot. And so if you put these guys on horseback in strategic positions like Times Square and down by World Trade Center, they can see what's going on and they sort of offer a deterrent to any would-be terrorists. And that is where their nickname comes from, which is Last of the Light Cavalry. And I like that because in the military, in foreign militaries,
if they still have a true mounted unit,
much of it is ceremonial. But these mounted units
of NYPD, the police department of the city of New York,
are still being used in actual missions. They're on actual patrol. And so, yes, I do believe that they are the last of the light cavalry. And with them comes the heart, courage, and tradition of the Civil War.
That's awesome. Cavalry. Yeah, that is a really cool story. Yeah. Well.
I have a lot of family.
So I know I cheated there. I cheated by doing a couple stories there, but I thought it was good to tell all those stories and cover law enforcement in the Civil War.
Yes. Oh, man. So, thank you so much for telling me that story, man.
Hey, I appreciate you guys listening to that. I appreciate you guys sharing your own untold Civil War stories. This is going to be a great hit on my podcast.
This was a lot of fun.
So, yeah, we got to do it again. Hopefully, we can do it in person over there in Gettysburg, you know.
That sounds like a great plan.
When all of this is over. So thank you again. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Guys, be safe and stay in touch.
Thank you for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed it while you were sunbathing on the beach, barbecuing steaks, getting tangled with half the Union Army, reminiscing about storming the ramparts of Chapultepec with old George Pickett, or whenever you listen to podcasts. I want to again thank Sergeant Donald Boyle of the NYPD for his help in the project. Also want to thank Craig Duncan for the music and Robert Hartwig for all his tech support. And a huge thank you to you, my listeners. You're helping make my dream come true. So please go follow me on social media and recommend this podcast to your friends. Let's keep the momentum going.